Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Welcome back to The Faith Explained. This is Cale Clark, and this is our new series, our mini-series on Constantine. Constantine the Great, a man whose life was pretty epic. He ushered in a new epoch, or epic, depending on how you pronounce that word, that affects even you and I to this day. And we're going to get into whether Constantine's conversion to Catholicism was in fact legitimate, how real was his faith. We're going to get into that question later on, but there's one more history lesson to be had before we deal with those issues, and it's how in the world did Constantine get control of the entire Roman Empire? Now, when we left him last time, and you can check this out in our prior episode, if you missed any episodes in the series, you can go to the Relevant Radio app, just look up The Faith Explained, or relevantradio.com, and check the archives there, share the podcast with a friend. We left him in 313 AD, the famous Edict of Milan, which he had signed, and he had really at that point put an end for good, at least officially speaking, to persecution of Catholics in the Roman Empire. And of course, he signed this treaty with his rival, his frenemy, if you will, Licinius. Now, at this point, there are four leaders who are left on the board in terms of who's in charge of the Roman Empire. There's Constantine. There was Maxentius, and Maxentius is dead now. He died. He drowned, fell off the Milvian Bridge during this great battle that Constantine's troops won. And there's also Licinius, and there's another guy named Maximinus Daya. Maximinus Daya. Now, Daya was the guy who still would persecute the church from time to time. But he was really the only guy of the three who was really into that at this point. And essentially, Licinius knows how powerful Constantine is becoming in battle, and he doesn't want to fight him. So he signs this sort of deal. Let's be at peace with one another. But Constantine, in the back of his mind, he wants to take this guy out. He wants to take everybody out, and he wants to be in full control of the empire. And we really can't underestimate just the tactical brilliance, the planning of Constantine. He had been very, very patient for years, building up his army in Roman Gaul, which is modern day France, and in Roman Britain. He also was able to keep the border tight against the barbarians, the Germanic tribes that always wanted to flood across the border. I don't know if there was a border wall that Constantine built, but he was able to secure the border. And the people were very happy about this. So even though he made mistakes in his political rule, most of the time people were pretty happy with Constantine and the way that he ruled. Now, personally speaking, he had his faults. He absolutely loved to be pampered. He loved luxury. He probably wore Prada from head to toe. And he built this massive palace in Trier, which is essentially the capital that he operated out of. But he let a lot of other things go. He spent money on his own home, but the public works are literally going down the drain. In fact, the drainage system of the fields, the great vineyards of what's now modern-day France, they got stuck, they got flooded, and there goes the crop for that year, and it really cost the economy quite a bit. So he made little mistakes like that. But he also, according to historian Justo Gonzalez, he also knew just enough, just how far he could go in terms of taxation without the people rebelling. So he would tax people up to a point, but no further, because he knew that they would kind of get their back up about this. So, but all in all, the people were pretty loyal to Constantine in his region of Gaul. He did, of course, have a thirst for blood. We think of the great gladiator games, or maybe the not so great gladiator games, depending on how you look at them, and all the human sacrifices that happened, including many Christians throughout the empire. Well, Constantine used to love stuff like this, the Roman circus. And the odd times that barbarians would try to get into Roman territory, they would be defeated, they'd be captured, and Constantine would have them thrown to the wild beasts for sport. But sometimes it wasn't really good sport. It wasn't even entertaining. You know, you think of Maximus, of course, Russell Crowe. Are you not entertained? Well, the people were not entertained after a while because so many barbarians were thrown to the wild beasts that they weren't hungry anymore and they just didn't want to eat anybody. So that was not really worth the price of admission. And that's the kind of stuff that was going on during Constantine's rule. Okay, so speaking of the rule of Constantine, of course, like I said, he wants to get control of the entire empire. And in order to do that, he has to take out his two remaining rivals. He's already killed Maxentius at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. There's still Maximinus Daya, and of course, Licinius. Okay, so how is he going to do this? Well, first of all, even when he fought Maxentius, he was so smart in how he did this. He only sent 25% of his army. He went with them, of course. He left 75% of his forces back home, and that was for a strategic reason. He didn't want any rebellions or any uprisings while he was gone, and he also, again, wants to defend the border against the barbarians. So really, really smart. And his army was so good at that point that he didn't need the full army to beat this guy. So what about Licinius? Well, Constantine, he probably could have taken this guy out right then and there, but he was really smart. He was going to bide his time, and he creates a political alliance with Licinius. And he basically says, Licinius is based out of Milan, and Constantine basically says, look, I'll let you marry my half-sister, Constance. And Licinius is like, really? Wow, she is absolutely gorgeous. I would love that. So I don't know how Constance felt about this, but basically Constantine gave her in marriage to Licinius, forming this political alliance through marriage. Licinius becomes his brother-in-law, and they're kind of at peace. So he doesn't have to worry about that guy for a little bit. At the same time, the other remaining pretender to the throne, Maximinus Daya, the guy who still likes to persecute Catholics, even though nobody else is really doing it this time, he gets in this war against Licinius. And Licinius, rather, takes out Maximinus Daya. And he's done for. So now there are two. There's only two remaining. And then there were two, but only one can be the alpha dog. Only one can be. Now, you would think that they would be able to live at peace. And many people in the Roman Empire actually thought, this is going to be an era of peace. After all, these guys are now united through marriage. They're kind of family, extended family. Licinius is in the east. Constantine is in the west. And this should be a period of peace and stability. But the problem is always human pride, human ambition, human ego, human narcissism. Both of these guys want to rule the entire empire. It's just half of the empire is too small for them. So inevitably, there's going to be a conflict. There was peace for a little while, but what happened was simply this. Someone tried to murder Constantine, and as it turns out, this guy was related to Licinius, his great rival. He was kind of a cousin, extended family member. He got away from the authorities, and he was able to make it back home into the east in Licinius's region. And Constantine's like, look, dude, that guy tried to kill me. You need to send him back to me so we can execute him. And Licinius is like, forget it. I'm related to him. He's family. You can't touch him. And this gave Constantine the exact opening that he wanted, because he always wanted to start a war with his brother-in-law, Licinius, but he needed some sort of a legit cover to do it. He didn't want to be the one to throw the first punch. He didn't want to be the one to fire the first shot. This gave him the perfect opportunity to strike. And that's exactly what he did. Going to skip over a couple of things, but essentially, Constantine eventually takes over the city known as Byzantium. And that city, he eventually will rename Constantinople, which quite literally means the city of Constantine. And this was a really masterstroke by Constantine because of the strategic importance of Byzantium in the east. It was right at the point of union between Europe and Asia. And there's, of course, this incredible body of water here. There's the Black Sea, there's the Mediterranean, the Strait of Bosphorus, and Byzantium is kind of right there. You can't get anything through shipping-wise unless you have control of that city. So it was incredibly strategic to take this city that he would eventually rename after himself, becomes a hugely important city in the history of Christianity and the history of the world. And he very slowly but surely starts picking off the territories belonging to Licinius. Now, this was in the year, we're now up to late 314. So a lot has happened in just 1 year since the signing of the Edict of Milan in 313 AD. So once again, there's a bit of a period of peace. There's a bit of a truce here because Licinius has to surrender a little bit to Constantine, but Constantine eventually wants to take him out entirely. Well, in 322, just a few years later, war breaks out, and this one's for keeps, this one's for good. And it has a lot to do this time with religion, with the Catholic Church. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. Okay, as historian Justo Gonzalez says, and I've been leaning heavily on his work on this investigation of Constantine, Licinius was painted by some Christian chroniclers of the time as being anti-church, hostile towards the faith. Was that really true? Well, you know, to some extent, history is always written by the winners. And so nobody has a completely unbiased view of history. But it's conceivable that he really wasn't against the faith in the beginning, and he really wasn't trying to persecute the church. But there were a lot of squabbles that were taking place. There wasn't always perfect peace and unity in the early church period, okay? We should all know that. There's still sinners in the church. There were fights. People fought. There were schisms, heresies, all kinds of stuff. And in the territories belonging to Licinius, there were some sort of fights that broke out, divisions within the faith. And sometimes they would spill out into the public arena. I don't know whether it'd be bar fights or, you know, demonstrations in the streets. But Licinius would eventually have to take a side and say, okay, you guys are right, you guys are wrong, and sort of punish the offenders to keep the peace. Well, those who came out on the wrong side, who were believers in Jesus Christ, they were, you know, people of faith. They said, well, you know, Licinius is against us. So that must mean that Constantine is the real emperor that God wants, because obviously Constantine conquered by the sign of Christ. Maybe he's the guy we should be hoping for and the guy we should be following, not Licinius. Well, Licinius didn't like this kind of talk, so he started to crack down on these believers. And that gave Constantine the perfect opening once again, because now he could present himself as, hey, I'm the guy that God has kind of anointed here to be the Roman emperor. Obviously, I support the faith. I support the Catholic Church. And I know Licinius doesn't like some of you guys, but I do, so you should follow me. And so he decides to strike. In 322 AD, he kind of crosses over into Licinius's territory. His armies go in, and the cover story is we're chasing a bunch of barbarians that got away from us. But Licinius is like, I know what you're doing. You're sort of trying to set up a beachhead in my territory here. I don't like this. So he sends his armies to fight against Constantine. Now, Constantine's army isn't as big at this point. It's kind of got inferior forces. But here's the problem. Licinius was super, super superstitious. And he knew all about this symbol that Constantine used to win the battle at the Milvian Bridge, this Chi Rho symbol. He knows it's a Christian symbol. And what he says is this. Licinius tells all of his generals and all of his soldiers, whatever you do, don't look at that symbol. They've got it painted on their shields. They've got it on their battle flags. Whatever you do, don't look at it. Don't go directly at them if you see this symbol. Well, as Gonzalez says, that's not going to do a whole lot for the morale of your army. You're basically saying you need to be afraid of this. You need to be afraid of the symbol, whatever it is. You need to run if you see this. So that's not going to work. And so they were easily defeated by Constantine's troops, and Licinius has to kind of run away. Now, he goes to Byzantium. He hopes to stay there. He hopes to kind of fortify that city. But we know it doesn't work because eventually it's named after Constantine, Constantinople. So we know he wasn't really able to make this happen. And so he's kind of depressed. He knows essentially that he's been beaten. He's been defeated. Constantine's definitely got the upper hand. And so he sends his wife, the half-sister of Constantine, Constance. She goes to meet her half-brother Constantine. She takes along with her Bishop Eusebius. And they basically go to him and say, look, okay, He's done. You've beaten Licinius. He's basically just conceding to you. He's going to abdicate. You can have the whole empire. One condition, though, don't kill my husband, she says. And he's like, all right, deal. So this is how Constantine got everything he ever wanted. He became the sole ruler of the Roman Empire. But did he break his promise to his sister? Well, we don't really know for sure, but a short time after this, Licinius turns up dead. Someone has murdered him. Now, some people say that he was setting up this, he was fixing to try to get after Constantine again and try to kill him. Some people say Constantine ordered a hit on him. We may never know, but at any rate, Licinius eventually does turn up dead. So there are no more rivals to the throne. But here's the thing. Constantine isn't simply after his own glory. He actually wants to restore the Roman Empire to its former glory, but he has a totally different plan than all of the emperors who came before him. Remember Diocletian, who had unleashed this incredible, the worst persecution that had ever been seen against the church? He thought that to restore Rome to its former glory, they needed to go back to paganism, essentially. They needed to go back to the worship of all of these various Roman gods, these Greco-Roman gods. And Constantine says, I've got a better plan. I think that the empire needs to believe in Jesus Christ. Christianity needs to be the official religion of the empire. And so this is how we're going to regain our former glory, through the Christian God. Well, people back in Rome, they didn't like this one bit. Think of them as kind of the career politicians of modern day U.S. political parties. I'm not going to name names, but people who have just hung on to power for decades and decades and decades. And this is really what the Roman senators were doing. And they did not want to lose power. They really wanted to go back to the old pagan gods. They were really frustrated with the spread of Christianity. And they didn't agree with this at all. But so Constantine got into a lot of fights and squabbles with these guys. And he basically decides in the end, you know what? I'm just going to build my own new Rome. I'm going to go to Byzantium and I'm going to make that the capital, the new capital of the Roman Empire in the East. And I'm going to call it Constantinople. I'm going to name it after me. And you know, again, it wasn't a bad place to set up a capital city because of its strategic importance geographically, but it was really, really tiny at that time. In fact, the city walls were only 2 miles long. So what Constantine did, he set up this huge spectacle. He goes there, all the crowds come out, and not only are there Catholic officials there, like Catholic priests and bishops, there are also pagan priests there too. And he makes this big dramatic walk. He goes far outside the city walls and he walks into the countryside, into the wilds. And they start asking him, how far are you going to go here? And he takes his lance and he's going to mark out the new territories, the new scope of Constantinople. How big is the city going to be? And he keeps walking and walking. And he says this, I'm going to go as far as the one who walks ahead of me. Oh, so God is leading him in this. Okay. And of course, the pagans thought, well, it must be the sun god. And of course, the Catholics thought he's following the God of Jesus Christ here. At the end of the day, he marks off this absolutely huge territory, but he doesn't have enough construction workers. He doesn't have enough building materials. So he starts taking stuff from other cities in the Roman Empire to build Constantinople. In fact, St. Jerome would later say that Constantinople was dressed in the nakedness of the rest of the empire, according to Gonzalez. That's a great quote from Jerome. And all of these pagan gods he took from pagan temples, these statues of the pagan gods, and they become sort of ornaments in the hippodrome, the public bathhouses. The gods of Rome have been downgraded quite a bit, but Constantine has given himself an upgrade. He takes this old statue of Apollo and he puts his own head on top of it. It's 125 feet high. He had an ego. Okay, let's put it that way. So when we get into this in our next episode, we'll figure out the great legacy of Constantine with respect to the faith. Did he really personally believe, or was he simply using Catholicism for personal and political gain? We'll untangle all of that in the next episode of The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. So glad that you're with me today. If you missed an episode in this mini-series on Constantine or any of our other series, you can go to the Relevant Radio app, relevantradio.com, download them, share them with a friend. But hey, we're not done yet. We've got to dip into right now our Faith Explained Q&A mailbag. Okay, as we open up our Faith Explained Q&A mailbag segment, I want to remind you once again that you can send in your question to me. The email address is faith@relevantradio.com, and you can also find me on the X.com app at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E, and try to get your question to me that way. This question comes to me from Chandler, who's written in before, and he says, I feel, Cale, like you have talked about this before, but I hear so often that Christianity came about from paganism, and all of our holidays are intertwined with paganism. However, I thought I heard you mention that Christianity predates paganism. Can you help me understand where these rumors come from? What is the truth? Okay, well, thank you very much for that question, Chandler. And I would say Christianity does not predate paganism in a certain sense, because paganism was around before Christianity began. Having said that, there are a lot of pagan religious deities and pagan personages, if you will, that people think Christianity borrowed from, and they used these stories, quote unquote, to try to construct Jesus and kind of build his story out of whole cloth. That's not the case. That's not the case. But one of the people that you might have heard of is a guy named Apollonius. Who is Apollonius? Apollonius of Tyana. Now, he's an actual historical figure. And I'm going to let scholar Gregory Boyd kind of explain this. And Boyd says that, quote, here's someone from the first century who is said to have healed people and to have exorcised demons, who may have raised a young girl from the dead, and who appeared to some of his followers after he died. And people point to that and say, aha, if this is legendary, this story about Apollonius, why not say the same thing about Jesus? End of quote. Well, for a lot of you listening, you probably never even heard of Apollonius of Tyana, but if you read his alleged life story, it does sound pretty similar to Jesus. So the implication is maybe the Christians borrowed this from Apollonius. Well, that's not the case. There are some parallels here, but they don't hold up. Why is this? Well, as Boyd explains, the biographer of Apollonius of Tyana was a guy named Philostratus. He wrote a century and a half after the life of this guy. Now, that's a long time. Now, when it comes to the Gospels, the biographies of Jesus Christ, they were written within one generation of the life of Jesus on earth. So we just know that the closer something is written, like a biography, in time to the lifetime of this individual, the more likely it is that the facts have been kept straight, because there are eyewitnesses who are still alive and walking around. And there were plenty of them, thousands of them, eyewitnesses to the life and ministry of Jesus when the New Testament documents came out. So there's less time for any kind of legends to accrue or anything like that. It takes much more than one generation for legends to get going. We don't have that with Jesus. There wasn't enough time. Not the case with this guy, Apollonius. Now, we also have four Gospels. We have four biographies of Jesus in the New Testament. We also have the writings of St. Paul that talk about the life of Jesus. Josephus, not other non-Christian historians and figures, wrote about the life of Jesus. So there's lots of evidence for his life. With this guy, Apollonius, there's only one source. That doesn't mean that's necessarily wrong, but the fact that there's only one source does kind of call it into question. It'd be nice to have more sources. Yeah, here's the kicker, though. This guy, Philostratus, who wrote this biography of Apollonius, he actually was hired to do this. Now, who hired him to do it? An empress, and she was very devoted to Apollonius. In fact, she wanted to dedicate a temple to this guy. So Philostratus, as he's writing the biography of Apollonius, he has a motive to embellish the story and make it sound really, really good, because she wants it to be awesome. Not the case with the gospel writers. They had everything to lose, no gain, humanly speaking, from telling about Jesus Christ. They all paid for it with their lives in grisly ways, except for John. Not that he had it easy either, but the motives were very different. Also, Gregory Boyd says that the way that Philostratus writes about Apollonius, it's a lot different from the Gospels. He has a lot of statements in there like, well, you know, people say that he did this, that, or the other thing. Some people say this young girl had died. Others say she was just sick and he allegedly brought her back to life. So he doesn't exactly seem like he wants to commit to this guy being a wonder worker, Apollonius. But here's the thing, and this is maybe the death knell to this comparison. Philostratus wrote in the early 3rd century in Cappadocia. You probably heard about Cappadocian Christians. Christianity had already been flourishing there for some time. So here's the deal. If anybody's doing any borrowing, he is borrowing from the Catholic Christian faith, from the accounts of the life of Jesus that were already out there. It's way after the lifetime of Jesus and how the early church got going. So the comparisons don't really hold any water. But even if Apollonius did do outstanding miracles, that doesn't mean that Jesus didn't. You have to take Jesus' life on its own merits. So at any rate, this stuff is later. It's after Christ. That's a pagan comparison, if you will. It's often made to Christianity. People think Christianity stole from this. Not the case. If anything, it's the other way around. And it's the same thing when it comes to the mystery religions. There are certain mystery religions out there that people think that Christians borrowed from when constructing the Gospels. No. Again, these were later than the Gospels. This idea of dying and rising gods, and this has nothing to do with the resurrection. When the pagan religions have this stuff in them, this has to do with the cycle of nature. Crops, they die in the fall. Plants come back to life in the springtime. This has nothing to do with a physical resurrection of a person, for which there is evidence, by the way, historical evidence. And don't forget, the first Christians were Jewish. They absolutely abhorred paganism and fought against it every step of the way. They're not going to believe pagan stories or stories borrowed from paganism about somebody who says that they're their Messiah. No, this is nothing to do with paganism. So again, if there's any borrowing, it comes the other way. Any parallels from mystery religions that have to do with dying and rising gods come from the 2nd century at the earliest, 2nd century AD. So again, they're borrowing from Christianity, if anything. So very, very good question. And it's not the case. It's not the case. You have nothing to worry about on that front. But you do hear an awful lot about this, especially at Easter time. Did the Catholic Church steal ideas from pagan religions when telling the stories about Jesus? And that's not true at all. These predate those false pagan myths. And these, the Christian accounts about Jesus, are based in actual historical reality. I'm Cale Clark for The Faith Explained. You can send your question in to me for the mailbag. The address is faith@relevantradio.com via email, or you can send me a message on the X app at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. I'll be with you later today at 5 p.m. Central on The Cale Clark Show, and tomorrow, once again, on The Faith Explained, or anytime on the podcast on the Relevant Radio app and relevantradio.com. God bless you.